I want to talk about something I've talked about a good deal with the monks, but I don't know that I've talked about it with the lay people the same way I'm going to do today. And that's, it can be a kind of oversight. Sometimes monks get so familiar with certain things that we overlook some of the premises of that are assumed, taken for granted when we talk about certain things. So this involves one or two of these premises and some elaboration on them with regard to the basic teachings on the law of karma and no self, anatta, karma and anatta. We're not men. I start with a little basic kind of historical background. The Buddha did not invent the teaching on basic idea of karma. You know, he didn't kind of invent that. That was already in Indian culture and Indian religion. The Buddha clarified what it really means, and one of the major clarifications came through the teaching on of anatta or anatman, or no self. The Indian religion, till the time of the Buddha, Indian religion taught that there is an Atman, which we translate as a self. It's probably better to translate it as a true self, something along those lines. And the Buddha began his efforts in religion on his own and with his initial teachers under the common assumption of the people who renounced the world like he did and undertook some kind of intensive spiritual discipline. And that general assumption was that the Atman, the true self, is imprisoned in the body of which it is not a part. The body and the desires, urges of the body are impure, basically, and due to accumulated karma, the Atman has become imprisoned in this kind of web of material being and desire and hatred and confusion. And that the business of the ascetic life is to conquer desire or attachment and aversion, hatred, and liberate the Atman from this kind of prison, so that ultimately the Atman will be freed at the time of death completely from this prison and go back and rejoin the Brahma, or the world soul, the kind of universal true self. And this was the intellectual, philosophical basis for ascetic practice. You can see why the Buddha nearly killed himself, being very sincere and being someone who followed out the premises fully in his actions. He nearly killed himself trying to free the Atman from desire and from the passions, you know. And of course, what he found was that the more you flog it, the more it fights back, and it doesn't work. And besides that, you damage the very vehicle, the body itself, and the mind, for that matter. You damage them both through that means. Remember, the story was that when he had nearly starved himself to death, when he finally accepted an offering of of rice gruel or whatever it was, milk or whatever it was, that the other ascetics, the five ascetics with whom he was training, were very disappointed and disgusted, and they left him. And then he just finally just sat still, first having taken nourishment, and I'm sure during the period of his kind of lonely retreat, or alone retreat there, he took nourishment and took care of his body, started taking care of his body at last. At last, the Eternal could get a word in edgeways, you might say, because he wasn't fighting so hard. So that generally comes under the heading of what our master called storming heaven. Asceticism is storming heaven. And it's, since the whole point of religion is actually to surrender our will to the selfish will to the Eternal, the well-intentioned use of the selfish will to storm heaven is, however religious in appearance, is equally unhelpful in the end to just going with the passions. You might say it's going with a particular kind of spiritual ambition, which is another passion. In that retreat, the Buddha discovered what he called the middle path, which is a path that transcends the opposites of just plain letting it hang out and indulging every whim and flogging yourself spiritually and physically in order to satisfy a spiritual ambition. He taught this is the middle path. Now this means he had different, his understanding of karma is a different understanding than the understanding of karma that he was raised with. In the understanding of karma that he was raised with, in some way you're the, what you think of as you, although there's this kind of true self, this kind of body and mind, which is not the true self, is kind of essentially linked to the past, and there's a kind of sameness of identity with those who came before. And the Buddhism basically, rightly understood, denies that sameness of identity. There's no sameness in it. I'm a different person from the people whose karma I have inherited. And indeed, if you think about it, I'm a different person than I was 40 years ago. And there's elements of sameness and elements of difference, actually. But you cannot locate one particular, any aspect of this flux of change that we call this body and mind, this process we call body and mind, and say, this is always the same. And this has very, very, this lack of identity between the present and the past has very important implications of a very practical nature in the work that we're doing in training. Yes. So that's a little background. I'm going to talk about the implications. And then next I'm going to show you a little chart here. There's two sides here. You can call one the fascination side and one the horror side. And they start out relatively mild, like and dislike. Then you have craving and aversion. Then you have clinging and hate. And these are obviously opposites. And microphone here. And as you come up here and as you rise up this thing, it gets more intense. And I've got a little dotted line here. This is where things get more willful. This is, by the way, this is just steps in dependent origination. These two, craving and clinging and aversion and hate, those are the steps in craving and clinging are the identified as the steps in dependent origination. But like and dislike precede. In fact, some kind of experience lies underneath both like and dislike. You hear a sound that, or a series of sounds that's pleasant, you enjoy it. If it's not pleasant to you, you don't enjoy it. You can't help that, you know. You eat something that you really enjoy, that pleasure is something you can't much help. You eat something that really puts you off, that displeasure is something you can't much help. Whenever we get a gift of asparagus here, I have to forego because asparagus makes me want to throw up, although I've tried eating it because people love it so much. So many people really love asparagus. But when I try eating it, it makes me want to throw up. I can't help it. Something in my body simply reacts that way to something that many other people like. So that's just physiological dislike, you know. That's a physiological reaction of some kind. It doesn't have any moral implications unless someone forces me to eat asparagus and I murder them, you see. Or unless I, night and day, I dream of my hatred of asparagus and I go on a rampage against asparagus growers and people who sell asparagus, and then I'm basically crazy, aren't I? And somehow I've taken something that was simply started out as something very simple. I've made it something altogether different. Well, that's a relatively trivial example, but the things we inherit from past karma are not so trivial or so obvious sometimes. Even if somewhat obvious, they're often much more of a genuinely horrendous nature. Because of the extremes that some of the people or beings that whose karma we've inherited went to and carried things in their lifetime. I say I've written fascination and horror here, and this is these identify one of the main points of this talk, and it's one of the things that I've talked a lot about with the monks. It's something that I've not talked as much about with the lay trainees, and yet it's something that's very important to be aware of, that when people have karmic memories start to manifest, which happens with many people, if not everyone, very naturally in the course of their training at some point or points, they can manifest with a kind of attraction or fascination, and they can manifest with a kind of horror attached. And they can swing from one to the other. It would usually go from the fascination to the horror. Start out with a fascination, and then when the penny drops and the actual experience and fuller memories start to come along, then the fuller implications are felt. In either case, it's really important to understand that the context in which we are training is the context of the practice of meditation. And that the practice of meditation, you notice I put these on the side, I've left something in the middle. I'll start to fill in what's not in the middle now. I've gotten red to distinguish it. This is where you want to be, spiritually, when fascination and horror really start to manifest. This is, you want to be in the place of stillness within yourself. And you want to root yourself there. And you want to look up in that place. People can very unwisely get caught up in the fascination side. And we've had that happen in our, with people at times. And when their experiences, memories and the like coming, or what sometimes start as memories but then start to be imaginings, for some people are different from what they remember and what they imagine. It's not very clear. Many of us, it's actually not very clear. At times, other times, it should be very clear, actually. But you have people start to get fascinated and then start to go down an imaginative road with these things and start to build on things and start to live a kind of karmic, confused fantasy life in their mind. At some point, that's going to flip over to the horror side. And if a person allows themselves to get drawn into the fascination side, they will be nailed by the horror side. They will be drawn into that. They will wake up one day to find themselves swamped in the horror side. The point of the meditation is not to be swamped by anything. Not to be swamped. To keep your spiritual grounding in the midst of what is arising. This is why meditation is so absolutely important in this process. In the extreme forms of the fascination and the horror, getting swept away can mean going insane. Now, normally, in our normal experience, there are safeguards, built-in safeguards to this process. In fact, there's a whole series of safeguards that are just natural to this. One of the safeguards is that people who are actually ready to do meditation try it, at least in the way we do it, and in the context we do it, which is really important. The context of teaching and practice within which we're doing our meditation, which makes it a whole different thing than most so-called meditations taught and practiced out there. But the person who's not actually ready to do it tries it, has an initial interest, and then an aversion to it, and then drops it. And that's one level of safeguard to keep from kind of opening their spiritual can of worms before they're ready. You see? But it's not a bad thing that there's so few people who actually do this. You see? Is it most people simply would really don't want to open that door, aren't ready to open that door. Another of this natural safeguard is that basically, unless one willfully goes down a lopsided, unless one willfully goes about training in a lopsided way, the more difficult aspects of our karmic inheritance aren't going to be manifesting until there's a very solid grounding in training, until a good deal of conversion has quietly happened. Or maybe sometimes not so quietly. But at any rate, until there's a foundation to where one can actually succeed at it when the going starts to get really rough. A third safeguard is that it seems that almost everyone who does this training has within the first few months or years of doing it some kind of spiritual awakening in which they get a very powerful confirmation that this is really the path and that they can trust it. And some initial experience of that which we call the eternal. That doesn't mean that everyone, I am not saying that everyone who does this in the first few years has what we call a kenso, because that's actually not true. The Kensho's not, I said some initial, at least some initial experience, a full Kensho is not like some initial experience. It's the whole. And it goes right, comes right to the essential heart of things completely, at least for a moment. And is always accompanied by a conversion of a major aspect of one's karmic inheritance. And it's also true that it is really common for people in the first months or years of doing this to have experiences that strongly confirm for them that this is the way to go, and that strengthen their faith, and especially their faith in meditation itself, so that in time of need they can remember, oh, I have a place to fall back on. I have a place to fall back on within myself, and a practice that I can trust. So the first main point of this talk is that you're not actually identical with those beings whose karma you've inherited. You're a separate person. You've inherited some karmic knots, some karmic jangles, and you've inherited some merit. You're not the same as them. This actually feeds into the second point, which is that if you run down the fascination road, you'll get nailed in the horror state. And you won't be running down that fascination road little lickety-split if you're not thinking of yourself as the same. You see? And so here's the third point, and that is that it is very dangerous to try to relive past karma. And to try to relive past karma is to fundamentally misunderstand what it is you're trying to do in life, much less in training. Think about what it is that actually got us, according to Buddhist teaching, into this life in the first place. A bunch of karmic jangles of pain and confusion. So knowing that fully, why would one want to relive what led to that pain and confusion at the time of death? And yet sometimes the clinging, the light craving clinging side of things can be so powerful that people feel an overwhelming compulsion to relive the past in some way. And the truth of the matter is that the process that works spiritually is actually a conversion or transformation process, and that it can't be accomplished either by just reliving the past and making the same mistake that someone else made and ending up in the same kind of tragic state someone else ended up in, or in reacting so strongly against that that one makes a whole other set of mistakes, which is the dislike, aversion, hatred side. That's why there's got to be a third position or another path. And that is the conversion path. And that's why I've done this, you know, I did this initially just as a kind of red pathway between the two. But I think of it like this, kind of like a streaming up between the two, being fueled by these, by the passions, being fueled by them. You're not trying to get rid of anything. You're not trying to reproduce something from the past. You're actually going to that place within yourself and then following a preceptual path. That's why the precepts are so important. It's by not getting the path of the precepts that we're sitting here. You know, other beings didn't get it. There's jangles left that need resolution. There has to be more physical, mental, psychophysical existence to manifest those jangles so they can get the help they need. So this is the path. Path of meditation and the precepts is the path of conversion of this dark stuff into now aspects of enlightenment. And this has no limit to it. I show it as a kind of fountain here now because of this immense surging of merit that happens as the conversion happens. It's not just limited to oneself or one's own stream of karma. It's simply no one knows how far it spreads. But it's great welling up of merit as willfulness is converted into willingness, as craving and clinging are converted to generosity, compassion, generosity, as hatred is an aversion are converted to compassion. See, so as I've so often said, the dark side of things is the raw material of the enlightenment. So if I am not those beings, because to say beings all the time makes it sound kind of like airy-fairy. So even though many of us have karma that's not just human, I'll just say people in this talk, okay, from now on. But if I am not those people, you know, what is my relationship to them whose karma that I have inherited? I'm not those people, then what is my relationship to them? Well, this is a fascinating, and I don't mean it in that sense. You know, this is a fascinating and a exquisite area, really, that gets revealed over time, really. And it's, if you remember where I started this talk from, this really shows the difference. What I'm going to talk about now shows the difference between Buddhism and the kind of religion, at least of the ascetics, that the Buddha started in. And why Buddhism is so different from what it came out of, even while it has some of the same basic concepts. From the point of view of that older way of looking at things, the pre-Buddhist way of looking at things, at least of the ascetics with whom the Buddha trained, there wasn't much to be glad about in the kind of karmic jangles that you inherited, or to be grateful for. That's because they're basically the obstacle that's preventing the Atman from reunion with the world soul. And this is carried to its logical extreme. This view of things is carried to its logical extreme by some of the Jains. You know, Mahavira, the founder of Jainism, was a contemporary of the Buddha. And at least roughly so. I think he was actually alive at the same time the Buddha was alive. And the actual ideal of, and not fortunately, not many people were daft enough to do this, but the ideal for the Jain sage was to actually eventually kind of stand still in one place so that he couldn't move anymore and actually kill anything by stepping on it. You know, and just starve to death. You know, to have conquered his body so much that he could actually just starve himself to death. And conquer desire so much that he just starve himself to death. And some people actually did this. Therefore, he's ceasing to do any harm whatsoever, therefore not making karma that would lead to rebirth, and releasing his Atman to the world soul. You know, the body and its desires and feelings and thoughts and the like are just a shell. Well, this is suicide, right? And that's killing too. But it's a logical conclusion of that particular doctrine. However, the logical conclusion of the Buddhist understanding is goes to a very different place. And that is actually that one understands one day that one is the beneficiary of all that karmic muck that one has inherited. The beneficiary. So that there is actually gratitude. It is said when one looks upon the stream of one's karma with enlightened eyes, one sees not a single speck of dust, and that is the literal truth. And yet, that's you, to get to that place, you have to go through some of these hells that others went through, at least briefly, you have to go through them. And how can it be that such horror and misery, you know, untold misery, and pain and anguish and grief, oceans of grief that beings are, you know, drowning in. How can it be that one could ever be grateful for such misery? Because from the point of view looked at with enlightened eyes, in other words, looked at from the point of view of where the conversion has happened at a very deep level, that conversion itself could only happen because of that raw material. Therefore, one is, peculiar enough, the beneficiary of the merit of the mistakes and of the confusion and the pain. And this is a very different point to come to than the other that I just described, where it's just this kind of rubbish that has to be got rid of. And that's why our Master emphasized again and again in her teaching, we're not trying to kill the self. We're not trying to destroy attachments. We're training self. We're training the attachments. Some people speak in terms of like the greater self and the lesser self. Watch out about how you think about the lesser self. You can, in your mind, you can very easily turn it into the lesser self is not part of the greater self. In Buddhism, there is no Atman and Brahma. There is just Buddha nature. And everything, including all the pain and confusion, has Buddha nature. Just to realize Buddha nature, to undergo the transformative process, the conversion process, is a matter of much training and much effort. But effort in the middle path, not effort storming heaven. So I think I said everything I wanted to say there.